Hi, welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Jordan Crook.
And I'm Greg Kemperik.
Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so this is the podcast where we review the latest shows and movies on Amazon, Netflix, Hulu. Sometimes we branch out just because we think it's fun. We also recap the week's streaming and entertainment news. This week we'll be covering actually 2 weeks of news because we took last week off because it was Jordan Crook's birthday.
Yeah, and I'm a diva, so I require no podcasting on my birthday, you know, no work.
Just a lot of, yeah, just a lot of relaxation.
Yeah. Anthony came to my birthday. It was fun.
Yeah, it was great.
I turned 30.
I didn't want to put you on the spot like that, but that's true.
No, I mean, we might as well be honest about it. I'm 30. I'm 30 years old. I can't, whatever. I don't want to talk.
Do you feel different?
I don't feel different, which is what's like upsetting about it, you know, because I feel like in your late 20s, it's common to feel like, oh, I really should have everything figured out. Why don't I? And like late 20s are kind of hard because of that, because you're like, I'm 27. Why am I still such a fuck up, you know? But then, you know, you turn 30 and like I probably am just going to keep being lost forever. Do you just feel lost forever? Is that what life is? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that life is just an endless series of being lost, really. Yeah. Just being lost day to day.
It's like a video game. You like start on level one and you're like, level one's so hard. But then you're like, oh man, I mastered level one. And life's like, here's level two. Good luck.
Right, if you're lucky. Or you just end up wandering around level one the whole time.
Yeah, and just, you're like, you know, looking at like, you know, IGN walkthroughs and stuff. Like, how do I get through level one?
Right, productivity hacks.
Anyways, I'm excited to have Greg on the show. Greg was on the Gadgets podcast, longtime TechCruncher, and
he's the longest running TechCruncher. I mean, in existence, I suspect
something
we
like
don't
that.
Count
but
that
not,
because
not,
he left.
He did
not. Yeah, not the longest. And Jordan will fight tooth and nail over this one.
Yep.
I'm not the longest, so we won't even go there.
Okay. Last, I don't know if you guys remember last episode we talked about boomerang TechCrunchers that leave and come back.
Oh, yeah, that's me.
Greg is a boomeranger, but he's been around here this last stint for quite a while. He's a big boss dog, so. Anyway, streaming news. What do we have first on deck?
So, first of all, we have this announcement by the CEO of AT&T, Randall Stephenson, that AT&T is going to be launching this new $15 per month streaming bundle. So, they already have something called DirecTV Now, which is one of these, you know, cable bundles, like skinny cable bundles. But this will be even cheaper. It's going to be, like, again, $15 per month. And I think essentially the way they get there is by taking sports out of it. And I think the one other thing that's kind of, like, funny about the news is the fact that it wasn't announced at a big press conference, but rather AT&T right now is in the middle of this antitrust trial to determine whether or not it's actually going to be able to merge with Time Warner. So he just sort of casually dropped this as a way of saying, hey, we're going to offer more cheap stuff.
Okay.
Just in the middle of this trial?
Yeah, well, he's on the witness stand. And I think they were like the Department of Justice. And there's like a whole, I mean, there's like a whole political context for this too, where I think a lot of people think part of the reason the Department of Justice is giving them a hard time is because they just hate CNN.
I'm just imagining them up there. Hey, yeah, antitrust. We're talking about that. Have you seen this new phone?
It is an interesting press strategy.
Yeah.
I object. Another interesting thing I think about this is like just on a grander scale. Like we've watched like ISPs and these folks like move over to content, you know, creation and providing content and buying up content creators. And, you know, the whole idea of like that moving over, I guess, to mobile. AT&T does provide obviously like internet service and cable. But I like the idea of offering a streaming service. I think it's like, you know, somewhat forward thinking. There's going to be a ton of competition. Obviously, there already is. I've always wanted Verizon to do this. Like, we have Go90. Like, you know, disclosure, Verizon is parent company to Oath, which is parent company to TechCrunch, whatever. I've always thought Verizon should like has so much potential to work around with, you know, creating video content and streaming it, and Go 90 never really, you know, met its potential, I guess. Probably because a name like Go 90 doesn't scream millennial. But yeah, I think it's a cool move. I'll be interested to see how it all plays out.
Interesting when you start digging into how TV works and how cable works, which I don't claim to be an expert on, but in as much as I've just like started following it more closely over the last few years, you realize that sports drives so much of it, because like those yep. rights just cost so much money. And so when you take that out of the equation, you know, the business model just becomes really different.
Well, and that's why like Hulu and YouTube TV are such a big deal. Like I harp on it every show, but like for years, ESPN and a lot of these like football games and baseball games and basketball games were like not, you just couldn't watch them unless you had cable, right? Like you just couldn't. And the fact that Hulu and YouTube TV have gotten rights to all of these channels that provide that, right? Like my dad watches the SEC Network on my mom's Hulu Live TV. Like that's crazy, right?
I don't even know what that is.
SEC Network, it's like football network that just covers the Southeastern Conference.
Oh. Like
it's such a dedicated channel, but it's available on Hulu, right? And that's a crazy thing. And that actually signifies the breakdown of bundling, I think, in a huge way. Because like Anthony said, sports drives everything. It drives the bundling that we've gotten used to on cable, which is why you have 300, 400 channels for, you know, $120 a month, as opposed to, hey, I only watch like 20 of these channels tops. Could I buy them a la carte? Like that's never been on the table. And these skinny packages by Hulu with like 40 to 50 channels, that's for $40 a month. That's a huge deal. And that's only because they could get, you know, the rights to stream like CBS and NBC and ABC that all have these big sports games on them. And I think ESPN too, ESPN, TOO and ESPN TWO.
Well, I think that's actually a good transition to our next story, which is a piece of news actually from last week, but is pretty big news, again, because of this idea that sports is such an old-fashioned and sort of slow-to-adapt part of the streaming ecosystem. And so ESPN, after sort of much kind of run-up, has finally launched its first, you know, direct-to-consumer streaming service called ESPN+. But one of the like big asterisks about it is the fact that you don't like it basically no regular ESPN content will be on here. It's all these extra things that ESPN has negotiated the rights for. So it's things like baseball games that you wouldn't see on ESPN anyway, hockey games you wouldn't see on ESPN, you know, non-finals matches at some of the major tennis match like Grand Slams, college sports, golf, Crockett. I'm sorry, wow,
Crockett,
golf, Davey cricket, Crockett. Rugby, and so it's a real kind of random collection of stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely like an insider or an industry tool. You know what I mean? Like like agents and athletes will probably use it, and like hardcore, you know, sports freaks. Or people who, like, have, you know, a certain affinity for, like, this one team, you know, that they grew up with that, like, doesn't get a lot of play. I can see maybe subscribing to that kind of thing. Fantasy football people, you know. But that's the thing, too. I was talking to someone recently about this new platform. It's like kind of unrelated. It's an esports platform for high schools. And they were talking about like all of the behind the scenes stuff and all the extra information that's important for like recruiting and essentially important for the industry, right? Like college recruiters have to have like a very detailed amount of information about people before they ever even reach out to give a scholarship. And for high school football and stuff like that, that's all available. But ESPN is doing all this stuff with like predictive analytics and like, you know, if he shoots this jump shot, you know, 25 times, he's made it 23 times of the last 25 times, and there's an 89% chance that he will make this shot. And there's an 82% chance that the guy guarding him will foul when he takes this shot or whatever. Like, all of that extra stuff is actually really important to people who are, like, deep inside the industry and not necessarily important to, like, the casual consumer. So I wonder how much this service kind of plays into that push. Because I know ESPN's making that push with, like, I think it's called ESPN 360 and stuff like that. So that's my two cents.
They definitely... I got, you know, well, I say got to, but I was somewhat grudgingly shuttled out to Connecticut, Bristol, Connecticut, where the ESPN headquarters is, and like got to talk to some of the executives there. And I don't think they necessarily are pitching this as a tool for professionals. It's more for that kind of like hardcore or underserved sports fan that you were talking about. But I could definitely imagine, I mean, again, not as a sports professional myself, but that could be a big part of the audience as well.
I thought you were a professional Crockett player.
Yes, I play Crockett every other weekend.
Oh, man. Henry's a big cricket fan, right?
Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Our it's editorial huge, director but just not in the US. Is like a huge cricket fan out of nowhere. It's just such a curveball.
Yeah, I think it's from the time he spent in Australia.
I think
they're big on cricket in Australia, and I think he picked it up there.
Because when we were in Australia for our meetup, we're walking around some parks on like a Saturday, and there were like kids like 5 and up playing cricket, just like hanging out in their little white, you know, uniforms and stuff. It was like what you'd see if you were like, you know, walking around a park and saw people playing like softball and baseball in New York. Just what they do.
Yeah. I've never played cricket. I want to play cricket. It looks hard.
I don't even understand.
Pretty sure I'd be terrible at it.
Yeah, like I don't even understand how it all works. Like you bounce the ball. Someone hits it with a paddle. I think there's base running, but I don't know. It's a mystery. I should probably like watch a game. I don't know why I should, but it just feels like
yeah. It might just be incomprehensible and unfun. Who knows? I don't. But maybe there are Crockett fans who are deeply offended right now.
Well, you know, it's funny because like this is so like random, but like I played volleyball a lot growing up, and we would watch. You know, the only volleyball that's ever shown on like ESPN or whatever on like major television. Is the Final Four for the NCAA and then the Olympics. And there was this guy who casted the, like, sports casted the volleyball games. And, like, if you know volleyball, when they go to a sport that, like, Americans don't tend to know very well, they explain everything in, like, hardcore detail. And, like, the setter is someone who sets the ball, which is when you use two hands above your head to softly lob it up to a hitter. You know, like, and I'm like, I know, dude. Like, like, I know. I feel like if I watched cricket, either it would be that, it would be like someone like really explaining it, and I'd be like, oh, I get it. Or it'd be like way over my head.
Yeah, I have the opposite experience where like I'll watch sports that are popular in America and it'll just be incomprehensible to me because the sportscaster assumes that you know everything and just care about like the minutiae of like what yeah. each play means and like, you know, the history of the players and stuff in a way that I like always find incomprehensible.
I find like sports are fun to learn about though. Like I watched football with my dad since I was like a little kid, and there's still stuff I don't quite get, and I would love to sit down with someone and have them just like explain it to me. Like, what is a nickel defense? Like, what is a nickel formation? I just have no idea. And I think there's also a dime, maybe.
Is the dime just smaller? I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. And it's like things people who play football are like, what do you mean you don't know what a nickel is? You know? Anyway, I feel like we've gotten off track. What's our next piece of news?
Our final piece of news is about Amazon, which, as we discussed in prior episodes of the show, is sort of doing this. I'll borrow a word we use a lot for tech startups, which is it's in this pivot as far as its content strategy goes, where, you know, it's really been known for shows like Transparent, which were these sort of critically acclaimed shows without necessarily like a huge audience. And now it's, you know, I think according to a lot of the reporting, Jeff Bezos has said, no, we are like going to do like we want Game of Thrones scale hits. And so they've signed on in the past, like to adapt to do shows based on like science fiction novels like Snow Crash. They also made this like incredibly expensive deal to do a prequel series to The Lord of the Rings. And then this week, it was announced that they're developing a show based on William Gibson's novel, The Peripheral. And Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan, who are the showrunners and creators of the new version of Westworld, are going to be some of the executive producers.
Are you excited about it? I haven't read The Peripheral.
I read a lot of other William Gibson stuff, but I haven't read The Peripheral. It was sort of, it seemed kind of like a weird choice because, I mean, Neuromancer is his most famous novel, but that's been, I think, tied up with like movie rights. And so that, you know, that I don't think that was ever going to happen. But like, there's, I think, other books that I would have expected to be adapted first rather than The Peripheral. I'm curious how they chose it.
The Peripheral is relatively new, right?
Yeah, it's his newest book.
Yeah. I wonder if it just perhaps was the most affordable way to test the waters.
Yeah, and it's an interesting concept for a TV show, too, because it's not set in one future, but like two different futures. And so there's going to be this weird, I mean, assuming it's a faithful adaptation, they're going to be sort of jumping back and forth between like a near future and then 100 years beyond that, which seems, I mean, I can't think of any other TV show that does that.
Okay, super weird. So is it two futures happening? Are they in the same universe? Like, are they alternate futures? Or is it like one future kind of far out, one super distant?
I think it's one,
the same universe.
One that's, yeah, kind of far out. And then basically, as I understand it, there's this sort of this like virtual reality game. And they start playing it and they think it's just virtual reality. And then they realize this is sort of either the real future or a possible future. And so, you know, it's kind of connected in a weird way that I don't really understand since I haven't I haven't watched the movie. I mean, sorry, read the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have nothing to say.
No.
Yeah, I got nothing just because I haven't read the book. But
I mean, I guess maybe one thing to ask is, do you feel like Amazon has become a more as I mean, a lot of this stuff hasn't happened yet, but I guess particularly with the Lord of the Rings stuff, does that make it more exciting to you to potentially sign up for Amazon Prime?
It's hard to think of what I would and wouldn't sign up for because I've got Prime already included with my Prime membership, as do 1/3 of Americans, we learned recently, 100 million Amazon Prime subscribers. I feel like Amazon has always been the one that kind of lags behind. It's like I heard Transparent. I didn't watch Transparent at all. And I heard Transparent was winning the Emmys and stuff. And I was like, oh, I should check that out. And it's like the same thing with Manchester by the Sea. Like, I'm never actively really seeking out Amazon originals. You know, and I heard some people get excited about Sneaky Pete. Like, I wrote about Sneaky Pete getting its season 2. And my Twitter like blew up. Like, there's obviously a dedicated following there, but I've just never, you know, there's nothing that's really drawn me. In fact, I'm more likely to go to Amazon Prime for like their backlog of stuff, like Battlestar Galactica, and you know, like the stuff that they have in their catalog, as opposed to their originals. But
yeah,
and to me, Lord of the Rings is one of those things. It's kind of like Star Wars. Like, I've watched them all, but like I didn't grow up watching them all. I like binged them on like a New Year's Day one day, which was a long day, but you know, like I can't find myself getting super excited about anything Amazon does. You know, I don't know why that is.
I'm kind of the same, and I was trying to figure it out recently why it is. And I think it's because for the way that I've got my TV set up, Amazon has actually kind of made it a pain for me to watch their stuff. So I've got Chromecast throughout my house. And Amazon kind of has a long-running feud with Google, or they just refuse to put Chromecast support into their app, which makes it a pain for me to get the stuff onto my TV. And they have a built-in app for Samsung TVs and other smart TVs, and it's just absolute garbage. The audio runs like a second behind the video, so everything's out of sync. And it's like, all right, fine, I just won't watch it, whatever.
The UI to begin with, like I run Amazon Prime Video on my Xbox One. And like the UI for that, and I used to have it on Roku, and both of the UIs are like just it's not conducive to anything. Like, and so it ends up being this app that's always kind of in the background, you know, like Xbox actually prioritizes the apps you use on your like home screen, you know. So I have like Netflix first, Hulu second, and then like a game, you know, like some video game. And then Amazon is always somewhere in the background. It's like I actually have to hear about something and get excited enough about it to open it up. It's not like a browsing experience the way Netflix and Hulu are. Like, I truly discover things on Netflix and Hulu. And Amazon is like, someone has to be like, you have to watch this. It is so good. It changed my life. You have to take the time to go and find it in Amazon's labyrinth of content and this broken UI. So I think that is a big problem for them, actually. Like, getting people to feel like the Netflix experience on Amazon, where you're like, just, you're willing to spend 20 minutes swiping through it because there's so much good stuff, you know? Like, people, I don't think people mind going to Netflix and being like, oh man, I spent 25 minutes looking for this, but I found it, and like, now I'm gonna watch it, and I feel fine about that, you know? Like,
yeah, my experience trying to navigate the Amazon app on, I guess at home, either on the Xbox or on my iPad, like, is that it feels much more also like, they really like will try to like personalize it in this way where you'll just see like the same five things in like every category, and I'll like, I think you guys have more stuff than this. I don't know why, as I scroll down, I keep seeing these like five movies. Like, there are other things I'm interested in.
Well, and their catalog just isn't as filled in. That I think is a bigger issue. Like, you can go watch like How I Met Your Mother on Netflix and like these classic kind of shows that people like binge their way through, Friends and all, The Office, you know, like, you can find that stuff on Netflix and Hulu, or Hulu, you can watch like, you know, all of Scandal, or, you know, like whatever it is that you love to binge, like this classic television. I just feel like Amazon doesn't have much of that either. So it's not one of those things that you're continuing to go back to watch like all of something, you know, like they have just like these few shows, and then the rest is just a bunch of garbage, I think.
Yeah, they've got Doctor Who, which is...
Yeah, they have Doctor Who, they have The Expanse.
Oh my god, I just, like, offended the shit out of so many people who are obsessed with Doctor Who.
No, but, like, it's like a handful. It's, like, there's, I think, yeah, they don't have, like, this deep catalog. They have, they were much more like, we think these things will be good for us to have, so we'll buy them, but we don't necessarily build it out so that when you're done watching Doctor Who or The Expanse, although, you know, no one can ever really be done watching Doctor Who, you there's not like the next thing to go to necessarily. It's just like, oh, all right, I guess I'll just go see what's on Netflix.
Yeah, totally. And I think I was wrong earlier when I said Battlestar Galactica's on Prime. I don't think it is. I think I bought it all. And that's why it's in Prime. Like, I bought it on Amazon, so.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. Great show, by the way. Everybody should watch Battlestar Galactica if they have it. Invest.
That's right. I've actually only seen the first and last episodes of Battlestar Galactica.
What? Oh my god, you watched the last episode without watching all of the middle? That's like... Yeah.
I did the same thing with Lost.
I don't even have an analogy. Oh my god!
Did you really do this, Anthony? Or are you just messing around?
You're no longer on the podcast. I'm sorry. You're not responsible enough to be part of this. Friend.
I mean, I am trolling you guys, but I'm trolling you with the truth. So,
that's not, I don't know. I honestly, I'm going to be upset about it for like weeks.
Did you do this intentionally? Or did you just go to someone's house and then you watched the first episode and then you went away for a little bit and you came back and the last episode
went away for 7 years and then watched the last episode? Like,
essentially,
what the hell?
That like, yeah, I hadn't necessarily kept up. And then I would like the last episode came up and then there came out and then there were like people were talking about it. I was like, oh, I wonder what happened. So like, I just, you know, watched the last episode.
You wonder what happened. You don't even know what happened watching the last episode.
Yeah, it was kind of confusing.
I'm really upset. Especially with Lost.
I feel like most people who watch the entire series don't necessarily understand what happens in the last episode.
Exactly.
So if you didn't watch it, it just makes no sense.
Oh my god. I'm still thinking about the last episode of Battlestar.
I'm not telling
Galactica.
You this is a good way to do it. I'm just telling you that's what I ended up doing.
Wow. I'm like about to rage. I've got to hold it in. Oh lord. Okay, well, your homework is Battlestar Galactica. That's what we're talking about next week. So good luck with 8 seasons or whatever. Four. they did like season 1, 2, 3, plus like the 4 hours or whatever, 2.5 hours of miniseries before. And then they did like 4.5, like episode, like season 4.5 and season 5, I think. I don't know. It was really confusing. But again, good luck with that because that's what we're doing next week.
Great. Done.
So, we got shows to talk about.
So, I think you wanted to, before we dive into our review of the new Netflix Lost in Space, is maybe also just talk a little bit about Ready Player One.
Yeah, Greg, did you see Ready Player One?
Yeah, I did.
Of course you did. I did too. And I read the book. Did you guys all three read the book? I mean, all two of you?
Yeah, I read the book long ago enough that I could recognize that there were huge differences with the movie, but I didn't necessarily remember what they were.
Yeah, yeah.
I have not read the book.
The book was one of the only things I've listened to on audiobook. I don't know why I did it that way, to be honest. I think I was like pretty into it, and I was listening to it while I was working because I like really wanted to finish it. And so I just like had it on in the background. So like I didn't consume it quite as carefully as I would a book that I'd read, but still like, I don't know. I thought the movie was like visually very fun to watch and like interesting and beautiful. I think the acting was a bit lackluster in some ways.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think like, it's not good or bad necessarily, but when you like strip a story of so many of its plot points and just change it, I think their goal, because Ready Player One was really deep in the weeds on like pop culture from like the 80s and like games from the 80s. And like, if you didn't play that or you don't know it, it could feel like a little bit of a different language. And I think that Spielberg's goal was to turn those things into something that were more universal and that like a bigger audience could enjoy without feeling lost. But it just ended up being like almost a different framework. Like the way to get the eggs was completely different. And there were a lot of pieces, like the whole thing happened in Columbus. Whereas like in the movie, there were like parts where he was in like Japan and Tokyo and all of the stuff. And there was a whole sequence where he went from being this like kind of, I don't know if he was skinny or pudgy, but he was out of shape, and he went to this hotel and got like full equipment to like be in the Oasis and like got buff, like running and like lifting, and like lived his whole existence in this little hotel room. It was like a huge, like they could have at least made that a montage. Like it felt kind of important to like the development of the story. I don't know. It's just for something that I had like, I remember when they first announced they were making it and like trying to find a trailer, couldn't find a trailer. I remember seeing the trailer and being like, oh man, okay, this is happening. I'm excited. And it just wasn't, it just didn't live up to what I wanted it to be, you know?
Hmm.
And I don't think that's because the book was so amazing, you know? I don't think that the book wasn't that amazing. It was just interesting. But like the movie just didn't even live up to the book, which is sad, you know? Could have done a lot with that.
Greg, what did you think?
Yeah, I think it was a really tough book to turn into a movie just because everyone would go in with different expectations. The movie was a lot of fun. I do feel like it was kind of Steven Spielberg and perhaps Kathleen Kennedy a bit just kind of flexing their muscle and being like, look what we can pull off. Look how many licenses we can get. Look at the VFX that we can bring to the screen. And then the story kind of falls by the wayside. You know, there's supposed to be this romantic element. I won't spoil anything for anybody who hasn't seen it yet. But like even the romance in the movie kind of feels lackluster and faked and forced. So, but the movie overall, I walked out saying, oh, that was fun.
I just feel like the book has this opportunity to give you this history in a way that feels like you've aged with these characters. Like it feels like a really long period of time in the book. You know what I mean? Even when he starts it, he's like, I've been doing this for however many years, like looking for these eggs, you know? And you feel like you feel like you've spent years with him looking for these eggs, even though that's the very beginning of the book. And then you go on for, you know, another long period of time kind of going through this journey with him. And the movie just felt like, yeah, the movie was 2 hours and the story played out in 2 hours. It was just like nothing matters when it happens in a condensed timeline. You know what I mean? Like you fall in love with someone over coffee, then it's not really falling in love, is it? Like do you really... Unless it's written so beautifully and the chemistry between the actors is so amazing, you don't really buy that love story if it happens in 10 minutes. Yeah. And that's what it felt like in this movie, like across all of the plot points.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a challenge that movies in general face now that everyone's getting into this idea of binging an entire series, is that these series have, you know, 10 to 15 episodes in a season to flesh out these characters and flesh out these relationships between these characters. And then you go down, and you sit down in a theater and you're expected to appreciate the relationships between the characters in 5 to 10 minutes. And it's way, way hard to do that.
Yeah, I agree.
I will say one thing that did work for me about that relationship, that the romantic relationship that you're talking about, is that I actually believed in the virtual avatars as like a real extension of the flesh and blood characters. And so it didn't feel like we were jumping back and forth between like the real world, which mattered, and then this virtual world, which was just a game and sort of weird looking. But like it felt like all of that was the same story. And so that the time those characters spent together in the Oasis still helped advance that relationship for me when, you know, in fact, they don't spend have a lot of screen time together as actors.
Yeah, I agree.
I think like one of the other things I'm curious what you guys think about that I definitely am not 100% sure how I feel about, right, is I think there a lot of the criticism of the movie and of the book is of the way it sort of treats all these different elements of pop culture as just like references to drop in, and it just sort of has this sort of, you know, celebratory attitude of like, isn't it great that like he goes and like dresses up as a character from his favorite movie and she recognizes it, and like that's one of the ways, you know, like that they're like on the same page, and in this way that feels fine, like not like too you know, like not awful, but like just feels very like adolescent. And then I guess, like, you know, particularly in the context of where we've seen some of like the darker side of this kind of fan culture with things like Gamergate, like it feels, you know, very strange to have a movie that just is just like, you know, celebrating this kind of very like referential nostalgic culture.
Yeah. What could they have done differently there?
I don't know. I mean, I think like maybe like if it was, I mean, maybe it's just it's a tough thing to pull off in 2018, but also if it, you know, I think some of it is just fine, have a lot of references, but have more of a, because I think one of the things, at least the way, and this may be wrong, but my interpretation is it feels like Ernest Cline, the guy who wrote the book, one of the writers of the screenplay, is very much into like just celebrating all of this, thinks it's mostly like pretty great. And then that Spielberg wanted to have this sort of more kind of moralistic tone of like, yes, we've got to, you know, you can't live your life entirely in virtual reality, but all that stuff feels like very bolted on and like unconvincing versus like a movie that was still like an action adventure, but had a little bit more darkness in it. Maybe like tried like in that really extended sequence that takes place in a classic film, which I guess I probably shouldn't reveal which one it is. I feel like there could have been maybe an opportunity more to, you know, like to interact with the film and think about the, and like change the way we think about that film as opposed to just being like, hey, isn't it fun that we're using footage from this film?
Yeah.
I don't, you know, because I didn't hate it, but I think like definitely there's some people that style of, and that just attitude towards it really like turned them off. I've seen it twice now, partly because I have like a friend who wanted to see it, although she knew she wasn't going to enjoy it. And I think like as like the references just piled up, she just turned to me like in the middle and she just said, I hate you and I hate me. And she just like, it seemed like she wanted to like crawl out of her own skin because it just made her crazy.
Jeez.
She feels strongly about movies.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I got a friend who's like that. Super judgy. I'm probably that friend to him too, now that I think about
it. That's what this podcast is for.
Yeah. You have to flex my judgment muscles. Okay, so let's go to Lost in Space then. Netflix, so just as some context, dear listeners, we have this series that came out in the 60s. If you've ever heard anyone say Danger, Will Robinson, that's what it comes from. The series called Lost in Space. And Netflix, you know, like back in the day, like the you know, effects and everything were pretty cutting edge, and the whole plot, in fact, was pretty cutting edge. But Netflix has gone and redone it with, you know, millions of dollars, and changed a little bit about the plot and a little bit about the characters, but it's mostly similar. And it's out now, and I watched all of it. I binged it hard. Like the first episode, I was like, man, I really hope we like this. Like, I hate when we podcast about something that I can't get into. Like, it's hard, you know, to watch stuff you don't care about. And by like halfway through the episode, I was like, I'm done. I'm in. I'm going to be watching this until the wee hours of the morning. And that's exactly what I did. Like, I watched it all in like one sitting pretty much.
And had you seen the old version of Lost in Space? Or there was also like a movie in the 90s, which I hear was quite bad, but I haven't seen either.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing. When I first heard about this, I thought, man, this sounds and looks really familiar. Like it's somewhere deep in my memory, you know? And so I was Googling, and obviously you Google Lost in Space, it's actually really hard to find out stuff about the old ones because it's like completely the new one is dominating SEO. So I finally figured out it's like the series from the 60s. And I was like, there's no way that I watched that, right? Like it was made in 1968. I was born 20 years later. There's no way that I actually watched that. Why do I have Danger Will Robinson in my head so firmly? It's because I did watch the 90s movie. Mm. And like, obviously like spat it out the other year, because I don't really remember anything about it except for that, like, you know, little hints of things. And clearly Danger Will Robinson. But, yeah, so I don't know about the old series much at all, but I did watch the movie in the 90s. I think it was like Disney Channel or something, right?
Might have been on the Disney Channel. I don't think they made it.
Oh, the movie. The movie was what do you call it? Was a feature film. I mean, a theatrical feature film.
Ah, okay. It might have run on Disney Channel then. Yeah. I don't think I went to a theater to see it. Anyway, long story short, I did see the movie, and I don't know. There are things about the series that are a little kitschy, you know, and a little like, ugh, you know, a little corny. But for the most part, like, I think it was fantastic. I really do. It's like in my mind, it's like the perfect show if you've got two kids like over the ages of like seven or eight, or any kids over the ages of 7 or 8. I feel like this is a great family show, because like as an adult you can be like into it, but as a kid, like, it's got nothing that's too super scary, doesn't really have foul language, like it's exciting and cool, and you see these little kids being really, really smart. Well, at least one little kid, the rest are teenagers, but this one 11-year-old kid is like a genius, you know. It's just like kind of, I feel like it's a great family show.
Yeah, so I'm just going to talk, and I might get a little bit spoilery, and if I say anything that's too spoilery, you can edit me out or whatever. Okay. But I just want to be able to speak freely without having to worry too much about that. So for anybody who hasn't watched the series or watched the original series, I think the general idea is that there's a family, they are on their way to another planet because something is happening to Earth, and then they crash for one reason or another. They end up on this planet and now they have to survive, and it's a full family. It's a mom and dad and three kids, and them trying to survive. And then for one reason or another, a robot comes into the mix and is quite dedicated to protecting one of the kids. And the way it takes a while for them to get the ball rolling. Like, I wasn't hooked initially. I wasn't super in love with it right off the bat. But then by episode 3, I was super, super into it. And to be honest, I'm actually really lucky that we postponed this episode from shooting last Friday because of Jordan's birthday, because I thought this was a movie. And so I had set aside, 2 hours to sit down and watch this movie. And I pop on episode 1 and I get to the end. And I was like, oh, shit.
You've got 9 more hours. Good luck.
There's much more to this. So I powered through it, and I really enjoyed it. Like you're saying, there's some kitschy stuff, and some of it's a little bit cheeseball, but overall it's good. And, you know, if I judge a series based on whether or not I'm excited for season 2, then this one was good, because I'm really excited for the next season.
Well, and I think they approach some, like, deeper themes there that, like, I'm actually kind of uncomfortable with how it played out. So, like, again, slight spoilers, but like, this is all introduced pretty early on, so I'm not ruining too much for anyone. There is an alien, and this was true in the old series too and in the movie, so, you know, this isn't groundbreaking stuff. It's in the trailer. There's an alien that lands with them and ends up befriending the youngest son, Will Robinson, which is where Danger Will Robinson comes into, because they're protecting each other and they're buddies. But Will is like, I can control him. And so there's like this one issue where you've got like these two species showing love to one another when they probably wouldn't naturally, I guess, or like as adults, or like as jaded, you know, humans, we might not be playing so nice with them, and vice versa. But this young kid, you know, finds a way to connect and really care for this robot alien dude who still doesn't have a name. And then there's the idea that he's like, I can control him. Like, he does whatever I say. he is my slave, essentially. And it's like, that is kind of upsetting to me. Like, why not? Nobody's ever worried about the robot's feelings, which he doesn't really talk much, so I get that. But like, I don't know, it just felt, part of that made me a little bit uncomfortable. Did you guys have that same reaction, or is that just me being like overly sensitive?
I did not, because, I mean, I think it is this thing where I think a lot of that is sort of the baggage from the knowing, again, I haven't seen the movie or the older movie or the original show, but just knowing that, okay, there's going to be this robot and the robot's going to be sort of like the servant, I think like sort of made that him sliding into that role seem more natural. But also it does feel like there's a little bit of a tension there, because I think, you know, that they wanted it to be a more complex character and not just this sort of, you know, unquestioning kind of servant who's like been like, you know, saving them all the time, but actually has a little bit of a plot and personality of its own. But then that makes it harder to accept the idea that it is just this servant for Will.
Yeah. You know, it just feels a little, and with anything, there are just like circumstantial obstacles for this family to go through, right? Like, they're on another planet, they have limited resources, you know, etc. And then there's like, you know, plot-based obstacles where there's kind of villainous characters. There's also just like general greed and survival skills, like fight or flight comes into play, where people, you know, whenever there's limited resources and limited means of escape, people tend to look out for themselves, right? So there's that factors in. But I felt like as we moved through season one and each episode, I think I remember watching the first episode and thinking, like, they can't keep up this pace, right? Like, how do you... The first episode had so many different problems in it at once, and so many people trying to solve different problems and running into another one. I just thought, like, they can't really keep up this pace. But they really, I think, did a good job of kind of presenting layer after layer of challenges that these characters we care for have to overcome.
They also do kind of establish this theme of like, maybe the Robinsons try to do too much. Because mm-hmm. oftentimes it ends up being like, maybe they just shouldn't have done anything. Maybe they should have waited a minute and things probably would have been fine.
Yeah, it always seems to happen that like whatever they've worked so hard to solve is like, they half the time they don't solve it. It's like someone else swoops in and is like, what about this idea? This could have fixed it, you know? It's like, oh yeah, maybe we shouldn't have gotten ourselves in this position trying to fix it our way. But I do think that like these characters, like if we could just for a minute talk about some of these characters, they are so awesome. Like, I am obsessed with the mom. What is that actor, Anthony? I assume you know
Molly
every
Parker.
Single Molly Parker. I'm obsessed with her. Like, she essentially plays this astrophysicist, super genius, with her three kids who are also super geniuses, you know? And she just runs that shit, man. Like, she is like, I am in charge because my brain is bigger than all of yours, you know? And I'm like, I agree. You should be in charge. Like, I don't know why anybody's not listening to you. I'm obsessed with her. I'm obsessed with the oldest daughter.
Judy, right?
Judy, yeah. She's a doctor, and she's just like, I feel like she exemplifies what an oldest sibling kind of aspires, I'm an older sibling. I aspire to be like Judy. Like, she steps up when she needs to. She holds her tongue when she needs to. She encourages them. She, you know, she's the one shielding them from as much as she possibly can. Keeps a cool head, you know, like, she's just awesome. You know what I mean? Like, she really is, like, mature beyond her years. She's supposed to be 18, but she feels older than that. You know what I mean? She's got it together. Then there's the second daughter, Penny, who is really just a tool for comedic relief, I feel like. I wonder how she'll be expanded in the second season.
Yeah, but I like that comedic relief character that they, around the third episode and the fourth episode, they start letting her develop into that, and they give her more dialogue. It's like she kind of crash landed and she was in shock, and so she didn't really want to talk that much. And then as she's coming to be comfortable with the situation they're in, she's turning back into herself, you know, this kind of snarky, sharp-tongued teen girl. And I think she's funny.
I think she outperforms the writing, to be honest. I think she is
she totally does.
Very, very funny actress, and she nails some lines that could be refined, you know, without going too far into it. Like, she, the writing for her could be better. Some of it's really good and golden, and some of it could be a lot better, but either way, she nails them. She nails her lines in this way that makes you laugh, no matter whether it's cheesy or great, you know?
Yeah.
So I really enjoy her, and they're giving her a little bit of her own, like, subplot, you know, with maybe a potential love story. We'll see. And then there's the kid, Will Robinson, is 11 years old, also a fantastic actor. And shockingly, he looks very related to Penny. Did you guys notice that?
I thought they all looked, you know, like they were kind of fit together as a family.
You know, because sometimes you cast in a family and you're like, there's no way that any of these five people are related. You know what I mean? Like, it's just impossible. But I feel like Penny and Will look like they could be brother and sister in real life. Mm-hmm. Will's probably my least favorite character.
Yeah, I think he's supposed to be, though. I think you're supposed to kind of think of him as being this little inept genius. You know, he's so brilliant, but at the same time, he can't stop getting himself into trouble.
Like, no matter what, it's like everything he does, you're just like, come on, bro. Like, stop it. You know, like, he comes up with these great ideas that save the day, but they're to problems that he created by being a dum-dum, you know? And you're like, we wouldn't have, it's great that you came up with this plan. It's genius. Like, good for you. But, like, you realize we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you originally just totally screwing up. Which is frustrating, you know, but he does have a sweetness about him, you know, and he does come in and save the day with his genius ideas, but he is annoying, man. He is, and he's like just so scared all the time. Like, toward the end of the season, you feel like he's been given some agency, like he's found a little courage and bravery, which is nice. I hope that's like kind of expanded on in season two. I hope there is a season two. It hasn't been greenlit yet, but. Everybody who's listening, please go watch it because I need a season two. Please go.
Yeah.
Go watch it.
Yeah. But they definitely filmed it in such a way that there doesn't, whether or not there's a season two, I'd be content, but at the same time I want it. So
yeah,
I hope there is.
I'm not going to be content. I'll be sending letters. but we haven't gotten to the most important character, I think, or like one of the more pivotal characters, which is Dr. Smith, played by Parker Posey.
Yeah. She is incredible.
She is so good. It blows my mind. Like, I don't know if I've ever seen Parker Posey play a villain like that. Have you guys seen that before? Am I just not remembering her?
No, I don't. I don't think so. When did she?
I mean, she was the she was the like the villain vampire in the third Blade movie, which I think everyone has sort of agreed has, you know, doesn't exist. And then she had like sort of a sidekick villainous role in Superman Returns, but I mean, I think, yeah, she hasn't been in something like sort of this big for a while and not in this sort of villainous role where, you know, she is really driving a lot of the action.
She really is. She's like the one piece that always keeps the plot moving forward because she's a master of deceit, essentially, you know, and she spins these webs of lies that even when people who are aware of her lies, are having a conversation about her lies, she finds a way out of it. It's actually infuriating as a viewer because you're like, okay, they're finally talking. They're finally talking about her. They can figure out what she's lied about. They're going to go confront her. And she's like, oh, well, I have an explanation. It's like, how do you get away with that? Like, how is this possible? But she, like, Parker Posey just does such a good job with it, and whoever is in charge of hair and makeup, the way that they're dressing her hair, she has this like Cruella de Vil-esque hair where it's like all just kind of like, it looks like she touched, you know, an electrical socket. Her hair is just wow out there, and she's always got this toga thing that she's wearing. I don't know, nobody else dresses like that. They're all dressed like they came straight out of like an Indiana Jones movie or like a roadster type thing with like high-waisted pants and thick belts and like cool leather jackets. And there's Parker Posey in the corner with like a toga type situation, like some sort of weird wrap, and you're like, how did, where are you getting those clothes? Why are you dressed so differently? But they did a great job kind of singling her out in that way. And Parker Posey just, man, she makes you want to choke her, and she makes you admire her all in the same line, you know? And you're just like, man, she does a fantastic job with it. And, you know, Dr. Smith was played as a, was a man and was right. a male character in the old series. And they brought in, they changed that plot up a little bit to bring in Parker Posey. And I think it was a great choice.
So I appreciate that she's a villain in the sense, and they're very consistent with her. At no point is she being evil or mean just to do it. It's just that she only cares about herself and her own survival.
And she's upfront about it.
Yeah.
She even says so. She's like, I'm not trying to hurt anyone. I just am looking out for myself. And you are too, by the way. She does that a lot. She flips it back on people and she's like, you think that you love your kids, or you think that you love your parents, or you think you love these other people, but really it's just selfish. They just, you love them because they protect you, or because you protect them, or because they give you purpose, or whatever. Like, you're just as selfish as me, just not willing to admit it, you know?
Yeah, I like that. I feel like and sometimes with science fiction and you know, sort of like action adventure blockbusters, there's a tendency for the villain to just be like so evil and to like, you know, make these like evil speech, and where you're just like, it's not relatable in any way. And also, like, you just don't understand why they're making the decisions they're making. And so even though she does some incredibly ruthless things, you never feel like, oh, I don't understand why you did that. It was like, oh yeah, like if you were in this situation and you were essentially, you know, amoral and just completely looking out for number one, that is like how you would behave. And so that leads to some monstrous things, but it always comes from a very human place.
Yeah, there's always a reason behind it, even if it's not a reason that as sitting on your couch, comfy in your home, that you'd be like, oh man, she's so evil. But like, in reality, if you were in that position, you know, chances are at least the thought would cross your mind, you know? And she does a great job with it. I really like the show overall, and I really do hope for a season two. I think that it, you know, we talked about Battlestar Galactica earlier, and in a lot of ways, I'm reminded of it, because not in the sense of the plot or anything, although there are aliens, or I guess AI or whatever, in Battlestar Galactica, but the reason, so Sci-Fi Network had been around for a while, and Battlestar Galactica was the first show that really put Sci-Fi Network on the map, and it became wildly popular. And the reason for that wasn't because it was like the best sci-fi show in the world. It was because it was a great show, regardless of the fact that they were in space or fighting for their life or surviving or sci-fi anything. It was a show about relationships, right? And like the drama within those relationships and connecting to people and feeling lost or alone and finding someone to kind of fill that emptiness. And I feel like this show mimics that in a lot of ways. Yes, it's set in space. Yes, it's on a foreign planet. Yes, there's robots and aliens and, you know, all kinds of sci-fi just baked right in. But at the end of the day, it's about this family who is willing to do anything for one another, you know? And I feel like that is what makes it kind of transcend your average sci-fi show or movie, is it's really about relationships. It's about people, you know? And that's what makes shows great.
I think one of the differences between Battlestar, I think a lot of what you're saying is right, although as we've already established, I am not an expert on Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, you don't even get to say the words, honestly. I'm mad you just said the words.
But like, I do think one of the differences in terms of how they approached the idea of doing a new version is that my understanding is the original Battlestar Galactica from the 70s is very much like a kiddie show, like, you know, like basically like a ripoff of Star Wars, but with, you know, even more sort of just for kids. And that obviously the new version is not that. And it was like, you know, as I understand it, not really meant to be. I mean, not that it's like super violent or sexual, but that it's a show like geared much more towards adults. And Lost in Space to me feels like, yes, it is an update. Yes, in some ways it is more realistic or gritty, for lack of a better word, but it's still also a family show. And I think honestly, like, I had a little bit of a hard time with that at first, with the first episode, because it just felt like I was like, I don't know how like how I, in my brain, I like fit together these sort of like genius kids on an adventure feel of parts of it with like these more like serious flashbacks and things like, and like I had a hard time just kind of, you know, getting my head around it. But I think by the time Parker Posey showed up, and that where you could have this sort of over the top villain, in some ways, I mean, like again, in her look and just just the fact that I think it's Parker Posey, like, but like that at the same time, she could also be like genuinely a scary and ruthless villain. And that again, that it could be a family show that was like serious. It that's when it really started to work for me.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, when I first sat down to watch it, I was, the reason I was anxious about not liking it is because of the kids, to be honest. Like, you know, shows about families, you know, there's this author, Zadie White, and she's fantastic. And she said the most complex, like, organism or connection of people that you can write about is a family, because there's just so much there to unpack. You didn't choose each other, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's, families are interesting, but to a large extent, if children are kind of a main part of a show, it just doesn't seem to appeal to me that much. And I think a lot of it's because many children are not as well-developed actors as their adult counterparts, obviously. And also because, like, it ends up being very, like, child-based themes, you know? It's just not as gritty or exciting as you want television to be. I think that the actors, the kid actors, Judy, Penny, and even Will, to an extent, is a pretty great little actor. They really elevated the show. So, yeah, it is a family show. But, I mean, there are scenes with Judy and Penny together, and they're scared and they're crying, and you feel scared and crying with them, you know, and it's a very adult moment that they're having, even as young people. And I think those actors are just, I really think they're out of this world, particularly whoever plays Judy just has a way of really tugging on my heartstrings every time, you know, even in silence, even when she's not crying or really showing much emotion, you can see what's bubbling under the surface. And I think that's a hard thing to do as an actor. I don't know. I'm a terrible actress. I got kicked out of drama class, but I think she's fantastic. And I think the kids really bring it up a level. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. I think that, yeah, particularly Judy and Penny, the actresses are Taylor Russell and Mina Sundwall. I also think Toby Stevens, who plays the dad, is really good. I mean, I think the cast pretty much is strong across the board, with maybe the exception of the actor playing Will. I'm not as sold on him, but I think a lot of that is the writing. It's not really the acting.
Yeah, I think it's the writing and it's Will's character. I think he does I think they do an okay job of balancing the fact that he's 11 with the intelligence of a, you know, a 30-year-old. You know, he knows so much, but he doesn't have any common sense whatsoever. You know what I mean? He's acting like an 11-year-old would, but with this trove of knowledge. And that is a really hard balance. It really is.
Yeah. The only character I'm not really a fan of is the dad. And I don't think that's any fault of the actor or the writing. I think you're not really supposed to like the dad. You're not really, like, he made his own decisions. He made some perhaps bad decisions back on Earth, and he's dealing with them now, just in the way that the whole family fits together. So I think you're supposed to kind of see him as this, if not a villain, but kind of an outsider in the family. But man, he makes some dumb decisions in those first few episodes.
I don't even know if they're dumb decisions. Here's what I think. Like, the dad, the whole point is, so another plot twist from the 60s version is that the parents have marital issues and they're combative with one another and they're lost in space, right? And the dad comes from a military training. So in the very first episode, you open, and the opening scene is the five of them sitting on this spaceship, and you realize very quickly that three of them are kids. They're young, right? Especially Will is very obvious in his little spacesuit. That's like his feet don't touch the floor, right? And you're like, oh man, this is a little kid on this spaceship, you know? And then when they crash, for some reason, I expected the kids to be treated like kids, and the dad from this military background 100% is like, you trained for this, and he treats them just as he would treat anyone else on his little astronaut space team. You know what I mean? And that, I think, as a viewer, when you watch a dad talk to his 11-year-old son and be like, you trained for this, go do it, you can do it, you know, and watching the mom kind of panic about it, you just feel like, what the hell, you're such a bad dad, like, how could you put your son or your kids in that position. Like, just you know, like, you're awful, you know. But at the same time, I think he literally was just doing exactly what his personality and his position tell him to do, which is, this is the solution to the problem, you know. And I think he really wants Will to grow up a little bit, you know. He wants Will to become a man and not be so scared, and he pushes a little too hard. So he puts himself, the show puts him in a position right from the first episode to make you feel the same way that the family feels, which is, he has something to prove. Like, he has to claw his way back into the family, and he has to claw his way back into your heart as a viewer right from the beginning. You know, you're just like, oh, you're so rough, stop it, you know.
Yeah, and I would also say, in his defense, I think that one of the things that is challenging about the show, that again, I think didn't quite work for me at first, but I think was really an interesting thing to do, is that Judy sort of has this, the eldest daughter has this traumatic experience in the first episode and is sort of dealing with that.
Which is just traumatic for all of us. Are you still thinking about it? Because I am.
Yeah, it's bad. But, you know, that there's this thing where basically no one else in the family recognizes that they, you know, once they're like, okay, you're rescued, like, just go back to being yourself. And you know, John, the father, is, I think, the first one to kind of be like, hey, I don't really know how to deal with this, but clearly, like, some really crazy shit happened. Let's talk about it. And he's the one who, like, really recognizes that.
Well, and I think that's also because he comes from that military background and he knows what PTSD looks like. And I think the rest of the family is so used to Judy. I think even in the first episode, Penny says, like, she'll be okay. She's always okay. Like, it almost to, like, to the extent that it's annoying. Like, she's always fine, you know? And Judy just has this air of her being like, whatever it is, I could deal with it. I'm always good. Like, I got this. No problem. Don't worry about it. And that's their older sibling as well, you know? And for the mom, Judy represents, like, an extension of her in a way. Like, she's there to protect the kids too. She's her right hand. And so he's the only one really that can see, you know, she's messed up right now, you know, like, she's not okay. And the rest of them just don't really expect it and don't know how to look for it. So that does warm you up, I think, a little bit to the dad, but he again continues to make these, like, I'm the boss, I can do it, you know, decisions. And you're just like, man, chill just for a minute. Listen to your wife. She knows, she's smart. She's got this. Which is another thing I like. It's, like, so rare, I feel like, in both fictional movies and TV shows, but also, like, in reality television. Like, I watch a ton of Survivor, and I'm always frustrated because there's always one guy on Survivor that kind of rises to be the leader, even if he's not trying to be. Like, and people just look to him. Even, like, strong women who could be great leaders just look to these guys to be in charge and to kind of dictate what happens. And I feel like Lost in Space has gone out of its way to make Parker Posey on the evil side, the mastermind of things, and to make the mom, Maureen, like, in charge, and they're good at it, and you, like, respect it. And even the people, you know, even the men around them really respect it over time. And I think that is really cool. It's cool that it's not, you know, it's merit-based leadership from them in a way, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, I was surprised at how surprised I was that, because you just see them sitting at the table, and I assume that, like, John, being the dad, is the one who's in charge. And then over the course of that first episode, you realize that's not the case. And it was really kind of, you know, a head spin for me of, like, oh yeah, I guess, like, because I just see this traditional, what looks to me like a traditional family unit, I assume the dad must be in charge, but, like, there's actually no reason why that should be the case in this sort of futuristic scenario. And I think but it also speaks to how unusual it is that I think we're seeing more, you know, competent, heroic, you know, quote unquote, strong female characters. But I think particularly in a family context, you just still are used to the idea of the dad character being
definitely
the leader and the competent one. And not to say that he doesn't. And I mean, part of the tension of the show is he sees himself that way. She doesn't necessarily. And that actually works really well.
Yeah. And I don't even think she sees him as incompetent. She sees him as not trustworthy. Like, he hasn't kept his word. And she knows that they could probably go tit for tat. Maybe not on pure intellect, because I think she's clearly leaps and bounds smarter than him. Just in terms of, like, you know, knowing what's what, right? Like, she she's an astrophysicist. She understands geology and chemistry and all of these things. He's really more of a grit muscle guy. But I think that it's more that she doesn't think he's dumb or anything. She just doesn't trust him to make the right decisions because he hasn't in the past for their family. And so she's very clear about it up front. She, right in the first episode, she's like, nothing happens without me saying so, period, you know, to the dad. And he kind of goes with that. And towards the end of the season, he actually at one point is like, you know, I'm not in charge. We're in charge. And he kind of, you know, it almost is giving more power. You know, it's like a 60-40 split between him and his wife. So anyway, I liked it. Please watch it so that I can get my season two. Just even if you're not watching it, just put it on. Let it play.
Just inflate the numbers, please.
Please. Yeah, I'm not against asking for that. Please do it.
Yeah, I think it'll be successful. And between the amount of money that Netflix is putting into marketing it and just the fact that the Lost in Space name is kind of recognizable, so anybody that kind of has that any degree of or sense of nostalgia about the original series or even the awful 90s movie, they'll click into it. I think it'll do well.
Yeah, I imagine the only obstacle is just that, I mean, I imagine it's not a cheap show to make, so it can't just be sort of like a moderate hit. I imagine Netflix wants this to be like a big hit if they're going to, you know, spend that much money again on another season. I mean, I think it will happen, but I think that's the only thing that makes it probably not as automatic as you might hope.
Yeah, I do appreciate the way that they've designed the robot here so that like 90% of the time it doesn't have to be all CG. It's just a dude in like a big suit.
But like in a cool way, not in like this sort of cheesy way that you think about with the 60s robot.
Yeah, no, it's really easy to forget that it's just a dude in a suit until you see it from certain angles and you're like, oh, that's just like a fake head on a costume. But it's okay. It all ends up being working out. It looks good.
Yeah, it's fine. I like too that like, so I remember thinking the first episode, when you first meet the robot, he's like this, he's got like six arms and shit and they're all like claws and he's just like, he looks scary. Like he is not, even if he's being nice, you don't want to play with him because he just it's just so scary looking. And I said out loud to Maria, I was like, he can't look like this forever because there's no way that as an audience we'll warm up to this. It's just terrifying, you know. And then the second I said that, he's like, I look like a human now, you know. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm good now, everything's fine.
Yeah, he's like a Stitch from Lilo and Stitch, where he has the extra arms and the thing sticking out of his back, and then he sees, oh, I'm supposed to be a dog, and his arms just disappear into his body. And
it's like that Jake was cute. From Adventureland or whatever, yeah, Adventure yeah. Time. I don't know what it's called. Maria likes that show. Anyway, I think we did good. I think we're done, right? Are we?
Yeah, so the last thing I should do, as always, is just remind listeners that if they enjoy the show, they can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. They can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We're also on pretty much every other podcast app. And thank you for listening, and thank you, Greg, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Greg.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Bye, guys. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week.